Okay, okay.
Seeing Joan White.
I didn't pass her office this morning, so.
The Department of Human Services administers this.
Oh, I have.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Oh,
great. Just telling you about the bill. 864? Sure. Okay. Well, I think Shannon is probably the person who coordinates that, and she's right there with the briefcase.
How does that work? Well, I need to.
It all depends. In the case of the example you referenced, Community Action
Center?
Right. She's right there. Well, I did.
LSS receives the money directly, and then there's a partnership type of a cost.
Some money comes to you, and some comes to me. The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. The first bill on the agenda is Senator Sharon's child support enforcement bill. Senator Sharon.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. Here to present Senate File 864. Before I begin, Madam Chair, I'm wondering if there is a possibility that Susan Gartner would be able to be third or fourth on the list of testifiers because she has not been able to come here yet this morning, so we can
sure.
proceed.
Sure, you can take your witnesses in whatever order you want. But you should present your bill first.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is a bill that is coming before you because of some actions that have been taken at the federal level. There's been, the action is as a result of the Federal Reduction Act that reduced for the state a significant amount of money that was used as incentive money to assist the state through the counties to collect dollars for families who have persons who are in arrears in their child support payments. So what this bill is about is as a result of the Budget Reduction Act, is to be able to find dollars at the state level to assist the counties in their collections and their ability to meet the performance objectives that are used in order to be able to get these incentives from the federal government. With this assistance at the state level, we are able to accomplish not only continuing the service levels that are occurring now, which help people stay off of other subsidy programs, but it also will allow the state and the counties to be able to receive additional incentive monies, not at the level before, but brings the state and the counties back to the level that they had before in terms of actual dollars used for collecting arrears in child support payments. What's important about this, why it's important for us, why there's value for us to do this, is that if we can keep this whole, we're able to stop a regression in our families moving back into support programs. When that starts to happen, we also start to lose other dollars that we receive because of our performances in those programs of keeping persons off of those subsidy programs. So with that, a brief introduction, I'd like to ask some testifiers to address and explain more fully this program. And I think we can begin with Dr. Ruth Krueger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ruth Krueger. I'm the Director of Employment and Economic Assistance for Dakota County. I'm here not just on behalf of Dakota County, but on behalf of MICA, which is the Minnesota Intercounty Association, AMC, the Association of Counties, and MAXA, which is the County Welfare Directors Association. I'd like to start by referring you to a handout that you have in your packet child support in Minnesota, facts and figures. Because one of the things to focus on is how important child support is in Minnesota. More children participate in the child support program than any other program except schools, except education. 250,000 children in Minnesota. And I'm not going to walk through all of the figures here, but for those of you who aren't as familiar with child support as those of us who live and breathe it every day, I would recommend you take a look at this. Minnesota really supports parents being the primary support of their children, not the public system. We believe every child should support their children and ensure that children receive basic financial, medical, and child care support that they need. This is pretty universally held in the United States, which is why the federal government has mandated that states run a child support program and passed all the basic provisions of child support at the federal level so that there's consistency within the states. Minnesota, however, is one of a handful of states that does child support in a state-supervised, county-administered system. So when funding is cut, it impacts on the county who actually administers the system. It's funded, this program, through the federal government, the state government, and our child support system. The Federal Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 changed the way the federal government funds child support in one very important way. What they did is said you cannot use the incentives that we pay to the state for good performance to reinvest in the program, and then you have to reinvest it in the program, but then you can't draw down additional dollars. Let me explain how this works. Minnesota is a high-performing child support state, so we get about $12 million a year in incentives from the federal government in addition to their paying for 66% of all the costs of the program. What we have been doing is putting that $12 million, of course, right back into the child support program where the federal government has been giving us $2 for every dollar that we put in. So for putting that $12 million back in, they give us $24 million. So the $24 million is what we are losing because of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act. The counties are losing $24 million. So what does it mean if the counties have to save $24 million because of this loss? Well, we have to cut $24 million in expenses. $24 million is the equivalent of 442 child support workers statewide, 37.5% of our workforce. Fewer child support staff means fewer families will be helped by child support collections. Fewer child support staff mean fewer dollars. 60% of the families that we collect child support for are former public assistance recipients. Only about 10% our current recipient. So you see that we're really serving 70% of the lowest income families on the child support program. What happens when we quit collecting or reduce the child support for those families? You will see many of them losing self-sufficiency, their progress towards self-sufficiency, going back towards public assistance programs. You will see more children in Minnesota in poverty. You will see, since one of the main things that child support does is finds private health care insurance, make sure that the children who have child support orders get private health insurance coverage and get support for child care, you're going to see fewer children with private health insurance, and you're going to see fewer children in quality child care. Counties and the state have both been instituting efficiencies. In Dakota County, we spent 6 months doing a complete process improvement analysis to see where we might increase productivity and cut costs. But we can't make up for a 37.5% loss in our staff. Expect that our collections will drop, and this is a range, somewhere between $66 to $150 million. We really don't think we'll lose 37% of our collections, but it's not unrealistic to think that we might lose 19 to 25%. 442 child support workers across the state is a huge loss. Wage withholding. We collect most of our child support through wage withholding. Expect more complaints from employers as our staff overloaded or aren't able to keep that system updated as quickly as possible. Expect that $24 million in lost revenue is going to further deteriorate. We aren't going to be a high-performing state if we lose $24 million and 442 child support staff. So we're no longer going to get $12 million in incentives. In fact, if we don't make 95% in our data integrity so that the federal government can trust the data we're giving them on how well we're doing, we lose all of our incentives. And, of course, the parents, non-welfare recipients who are using the system, pay a fee for using the system. And if we collect fewer dollars, it's a percentage, 1% of what we collect. If we collect fewer dollars, the revenue in fees will go down. You can see the downward spiral that's going to happen to Minnesota's. So the best solution for families in Minnesota is that the state would invest $8 million. Since the federal government gives us $2 for every one they put in, they would give us 16. With the state's 8 and the federal government's 16, counties would be back at the $24 million that we're losing, and you would ensure that we're going to continue doing quality service in locating parents, establishing paternity, establishing and enforcing court orders, reviewing and modifying orders, implementing that new guideline system that we've all been working on for the last 6 years that came up January 1st, working with other states to enforce orders when one parent doesn't live in Minnesota, and, of course, collecting and processing payments. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Krueger. The next presenter is Brian Beeman from Fribourne County. He's the Director of Community Services in Fribourne County.
Good morning, and thank you to the committee for my opportunity to testify today. As mentioned, my name is Brian Beeman. I am the Director of Human Services from Fribourne County, a geographic location for you. That's Albert Lea, Minnesota. So I came up through the snow for our testimony today. Not only am I testifying today as a representative of Fribourne County, but I also speak as the committee chairman of the MACSA Committee on Child Support, and as well I am an appointed member of the Minnesota Family Support and Recoveries Council. Today my responsibility is to share our perspective from Greater Minnesota in regards to the need for continued financial support of the child support program through Senate File 864. Roughly, there are 79 counties in Greater Minnesota who establish, maintain, and provide services to 40% of all of the open child support cases in the state of Minnesota. Fribourne County and other rural counties from Greater Minnesota support Senate File 864, authored by Senator Sharon, and we would urge the committee to approve this bill. As mentioned earlier, the federal 2005 Deficit Reduction Act will specifically cut $8 million from the child support administrative funding statewide in Minnesota. Also mentioned was that the $8 million cut actually multiplies to a cut of $24 million to the counties. Now, just a little brief background on Fribourne County. We have a caseload size of about 1,700 families. We have 7 staff who gather the information for our county attorney for the divorce and or the payment modification hearings that we have. Fribourne County has deeply invested in the training and the time spent to allow the experience of our workers to grow in working in child support. As mentioned, with the cuts, Fribourne County is anticipating just under $200,000 in federal cuts projected for October 1st of this year. Locally, we would need to raise our county levy an additional $65,000 just to maintain our present program efforts in Freeborn County. So as a county director, my options are limited. We can ask that the county commissioners increase our county levy, which of course increases our local property taxes, or we will be needed to reduce our expenses either through the reduction of staff or changing our priorities on how we serve our clients. I personally don't like the idea of having to reduce staff, especially now as counties are facing larger caseload sizes and the implementation of the new state support guidelines. Currently, more staff time is being spent on each of those cases as we massage the bugs out of this new process. Other areas that we will have concern in will be, with less staff, I will need to shift caseload sizes to those staff that are remaining, potentially reducing our ability to meet our federal outcome measures. If we fail to meet those outcome measures, not only will our county lose funding, but the state of Minnesota will also lose funding. A concern I will have will be the consistency across the state on the case management of child support, as many counties will undoubtedly prioritize different than Freeborn County on how they will address child support. What was mentioned, we will be seeing an increase in complaints, not just from employers because the wage withholdings are no longer timely because of our priorities, but we'll also see an increase in customer complaints. And at the local level and local government, that is one of my main majority of my complaints will come from the parties involved in a dispute over the child support payments. My last point is, if Freeborn County is faced with changing client priorities, we would shift our look to serving our public assistance population and minimize our involvement in the non-public assistance populations. Again, this ripple effect will cause the non-custodial assistant parents to hire their own attorneys and manage their own cases. Many of the families will survive, but many others will falter and will need to seek out additional resources, mainly through public assistance. As a county, Freeborn County would be concerned about no longer being in compliance, as we are no longer providing services to everyone that would be eligible. What are the penalties for being out of compliance? And it would be a loss to everyone involved in the child support process. Our goal as counties is to support clients to attain self-sufficiency, and this is accomplished through consistent monthly support payments made by non-custodial parents. Our goal can be supported through the passage of Senate File 864, and I would gladly answer any questions that the committee may have at this time.
Are there any questions? I might just point out that the income level, the exit level for a two-parent family off of MFIP is pretty low income to be expecting someone to be able to hire their own attorney.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I agree. I'm hoping that as the committee members are listening to the testifiers, they hear the domino effect of what happens here, not only in terms of limiting our ability to collect these child support payments, but the implications of that in not only the lives of the families, but on other programs that will increase, there'll be increased demand on other programs because of their inability to get this child support payment paid. Thank you very much. The next presenter with us got through the snow, the sleet, the rain, and I'd like to introduce Susan Gartner from Ramsey County Attorney.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Susan Gertner, the Ramsey County Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of Senate File 864, which I think is a very, very important measure. Child support is extremely important for families in our community. As the Ramsey County Attorney, I am concerned with both child well-being and public safety, and the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 will have a devastating impact on our ability to collect child support for the families in our community. What does it mean for Ramsey County? It means that fewer paternity and child support orders will be established, and fewer families will receive child support, and the child support they do receive will not be as timely. In our county, 77% of the families we serve either receive public assistance or have previously received public assistance. Receiving child support in a timely manner helps those families get off of public assistance and stay off of public assistance. We have worked very hard in Ramsey County to make sure that families receive the child support they deserve. And without this support, many more families, children, will grow up in poverty and face uphill struggles in life. Without revenue to replace the DEFRA cuts, we will need to make severe reductions in our child support programs and services very soon. And these cuts will, as I said, mean fewer self-sufficient families, more dependency on public assistance, and sad consequences for the children throughout our state. As you know, there is growing evidence that children in single-parent families who regularly receive child support do better in a variety of ways, better than children who do not receive such support, such as they do better in school. They have more involvement from their fathers. And as I have said, the DEFRA cuts will make it extremely difficult for our office and other child support agencies to ensure that children get the financial support that they need. The last thing I want to say is I'm going to answer the question that probably was in your mind as I stepped up to the podium. Why is Susan Gertner the Ramsey County Attorney, probably best known for being a tough prosecutor, here to talk about child support? Well, there's two reasons. As I say, I'm very concerned about child well-being. I am the only county attorney in the state of Minnesota that has full responsibility for the collection of child support, and I take that responsibility very seriously. I believe that we need to do this for the well-being of the children in my community, Ramsey County. The other reason is that I have always said since the day I got elected that child support enforcement is the number one crime prevention program that I do. And I've said that based on statistics and information that, you know, you could pile up for a very high way. But let me tell you that that message that you read from the statistics from the studies came home to me in a very clear way now, over a decade ago. You probably all remember the Devisha Gilliam shooting, the poor four-year-old who was caught in gang crossfire in St. Paul in 1995. Well, after that incident happened, the community was outraged, as you can imagine, and they gathered a community meeting in St. Paul of all the elected officials, myself, the mayor, the sheriff, everyone else, and there was all kinds of discussion about what can we do about crime in St. Paul. Fortunately, the organizers of that meeting had the good sense to bring some folks in there who could really tell us what we need to do. They were about a half a dozen young men from Boys Totem Town, which, as you probably know, is the secure facility in Ramsey County for juveniles who've committed serious crimes. And there was one young man. He had this T-shirt on and tattoos and a shaved head, and he looked pretty fearsome. And they said to him, "What can we do about crime in Ramsey County?" And this young man said, "My dad left when I was 3 years old. And if my mother had ever gotten one dime of child support, I wouldn't be where I am today." You don't forget something like that. And you fight and you fight and you fight for child support, sufficient child support. And that's why I'm here today on behalf of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Ms. Gertner.
Thank you very much,
Senator.
Susan Gertner. The next presenter that will be speaking to this subject is Mark McAfee from Ask Me, Council 5.
Good morning, Mr. McAfee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee, representing Ask Me, Council 5. We have represent a number of the frontline workers in several counties in the metro area that deal with child support enforcement. Our sister council, 65, represents people in a number of the greater Minnesota areas. And I think as a number of the earlier speakers have so ably represented, we really need to get people back to work, have them in school, keep them ultimately out of the correction system. With me today, and on my left of Senator Sharon, is John Ewalt. John is one of our local leaders. He works in child support enforcement in Ramsey County.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Ewalt.
Morning. My name is John Ewalt, and I've been a child support enforcement agent for Ramsey County for about 9 years. I'm currently the president of Ask Me Local 8, and I serve on the Council 5 Executive Board. I'm here today to ask you to restore some of the cuts left by DEFRA. Ramsey County is in a situation where we could lose up to 35 child support positions. Ramsey County handles over 35,000 cases, and I'm currently maintaining a caseload of about 550 child support cases. In 2008, we expect to lose $2.1 million in our budget, which can result in a layoff of, again, about 35 of our positions. And that will basically make it nearly impossible to ensure that the single parents we serve receive the support that they need. Many of our clients rely on us to keep them financially afloat, and without child support we collect, many of my clients would qualify for public assistance. The federal cuts are pound foolish. It's short-sighted to cut services that save taxpayers money, and every dollar that you invest in child support in Ramsey County means a return on your investment of $4.68, which goes to those parties to make sure that they are on the road to be less dependent or not dependent at all on the public assistance system. I have clients who went from years of dependency on MFIP and AFDC to becoming self-sufficient through our child support transitional programs like Child Care Assistance, Minnesota Care, Diversionary Work Program. Not only have these citizens become independent from public assistance, but their children, their children's children, now have a lower probability of becoming dependent upon the system. The goal of the TANF legislation was to create a path from welfare to work, and child support is a critical piece in that process. My job is to basically hold parents accountable and make sure they support their children financially. And, you know, when I make a difference, it doesn't always show up on federal reports or state reports of how we do, and it doesn't always end up in more money from the feds or less money from the feds. I had a situation where a case where at a 9-year-old boy who had never met his father, the parents had lost contact shortly after the birth. Of course, a 9-year-old son wants to, you know, is getting to the point where he wants to know who his father is, what kind of person he is. All his friends at school are talking about their fathers. The mother called me and said, you know, he's talking a lot about this. I have no idea where the father lives. Can you help me? And what I suggested she do is write a letter to the father, have the child write a letter to the father, and forward it to me, and then I would forward it to the address that I have for the father, in this case, non-custodial parent. The father got the letter, and I tell you, when I got the letter, it was heart-wrenching. You know, you have this 9-year-old kid writing this letter. He's drawing SpongeBob SquarePants in the margins, and he included a picture of himself in his little karate outfit. When the father got this, he responded, and from that point forward, became very involved in that child's life, started going to karate every week, renewed the relationship, a good relationship with the mother, and from this point forward, he's very active in that child's life. Those are the little things. The little things that we spend our time on and as child support agents that we will not be able to do if my caseload is 800 or 900 because a third of our staff is lost. I take great pride in the work we do. I take great pride in keeping people self-sufficient, and I take pride in saving the taxpayers' money in the work I do. Don't let Minnesota pay the price for federal neglect. These cuts are pound foolish, and we will pay dearly in the long run if we don't restore these cuts now. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ewald. Are there any questions? Senator Brittner Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ewald or Senator Sharon, I'm sorry that I came in the middle of your presentation, but did you mention how many child support enforcement dollars were lost across the state through the Federal Deficit Reduction Act?
Senator Sharon?
I think I'm going to have somebody come up. I have some numbers here, but I want to make sure that they're accurate. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, $24 million statewide.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, you're asking for just $5.9 million at this time?
I think The request is for in the bill that we have. There's an open appropriation. We are asking for the $8 million, somewhere in the range of $8 million, in order to receive a $15,500,000 match that will make that will come to us because there's a 66% match from the federal government. And with that 66% match, we are able to make up the $24 million that is lost. So the investment that we're asking here is to catch a 66% match that brings us back up to the number that would be lost without that action on our part.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's, you know, that's the critical issue. The stories that we've heard here are about what the consequences are in the lives of Minnesotans and on other programs in terms of personal sustainability of independence and in their lives and in crime, But the issue in front of us really is whether or not we can see the enormous benefit that would come from finding this appropriation, because we can capture 66% incentive against that appropriation to bring back an additional $24 million into this program that the state gives to the counties to carry out this program.
And Senator Solon, one of the little bit of complicating factors here that we need to remember is that the federal fiscal year is different than the state fiscal year. And so this is a reduction that we would anticipate beginning in October.
Okay. Thank you.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So what happens this year is a little less needed less this year than it would be for next year in terms of appropriation. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
Yes. Any other questions? I guess I have one question for the folks from the counties, and that, you know, is a question that I don't especially enjoy asking, but I understand that some of the counties have some reserves. Has there been any contemplation at the county level of using any of these reserves to help with this problem? Or is there any capacity for any levy to help with the problem?
Madam Chair, Ruth Kruger, Dakota County. Certainly there's a lot of discussion at the county level, and it varies to some extent from county to county. The problem that counties are having is, and you probably are hearing about this too, is this is only one of several cuts from the Federal Deficit Reduction Act that we're struggling. The other one is in targeted case management, which is child safety related, to fund our child protection system. So that's a high priority also. In the programs I supervise, the Employment and Economic Assistance programs, basically the welfare programs, in the last 5 years, my medical caseloads have gone up 70% in the caseload size, and my food support caseloads doubled. And so we're really struggling to provide services right now. Without looking at how we might add something like this. Medical is growing, food support is growing, so many needs are growing that to take a hit like this would be, and I'm Dakota, and we're, as you know, a county with some reserves, and it's difficult for us. So I know outstate there are counties simply that are not able to put money in and are really struggling with all of the challenges. Not to mention that we hear a lot about property tax. reduction, property tax, property tax, property tax seems
well,
to be
it is
theme.
A reluctant comment that I made, but you know this is not in the governor's budget, and I'm just assuming anything we can do would help.
Well, I think that's a given, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Senator Lori.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and testifiers. I'm wondering, I'm hearing that if we lose this $24 million, we will be losing money for custodial parents that are on the edge and will likely go onto various public programs, MFIP, Medicaid. Is there any attempt, I don't see anything on the fiscal note, is there any attempt to quantify how much this is going to mean in additional costs elsewhere in the state's budget that would help maybe put this in context? I mean, I'm understanding that if we lose this entire $24 million, we're going to see costs show up elsewhere on the state's budget, and I'm wondering if there's any attempt to quantify what those costs might be.
Madam Chair, that would be beyond the capacity of the counties to do, but perhaps someone from the department has.
Well, I guess we could ask the question as to whether the department, since the governor's budget has not included this in their recommendations, whether they're forecasting any caseload growth because of the lack of the collection of child support.
Madam Chair, we have someone from the State Department that might be able to answer this question.
Madam Chair, my name is Waylon Campbell, and I'm the director of the Child Support Program in Minnesota. The members of the committee, we haven't done a formal analysis of the cost avoidance that the Child Support Program provides. But we feel strongly that it does provide cost avoidance. The Urban Institute, I believe they're in Washington, in 1999 did a study that said that for every dollar collected in child support, there's a 40 cent cost avoidance in medical assistance, TANF, housing programs. Did I say medical?
Yeah.
Kind of across the board. And that is for every dollar collected in public assistance, there would be a 40-cent saving. They also forecast or predicted that there would be a 19-cent cost avoidance for every dollar collected on a non-public assistance case. But we haven't quantified that in terms of Minnesota.
So there has been no recognition of it in the budget forecast.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So I guess if we're not able to fund this item, then it would be showing up in the November forecast for this year?
Madam Chair, that's possibly correct.
Well, I realize that you're not with the forecasting part of the department or the budget analysis part of the department, but I just have to say publicly that I guess I am not exactly comfortable with the way the department forecasts these, the impact of these federal reductions. You know, the way they do it is they wait until the reduction actually occurs, and then they wait to see what the trend line is as a result of it, and then they forecast it. But that, you know, after the fact type of forecasting leaves us in a difficult position because it's like, you know, you're waiting to see if the bridge is falling in before you decide to tell the cars they should stop driving on it, you know. And so once it's happening, then it's a little bit harder to respond in a timely enough fashion to avoid that hit to the budget. Well, any other questions? Senator Lori.
If I could just for 1 second follow up on this a little bit and ask, for every dollar invested in child support collections, how many dollars do we get back? How many dollars do we get for the custodial parent?
I think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we get about $4 and It's over $4. I don't know what the cents part of it is. $4.20, $4.08, something in that nature.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ramsey County's state report was for every dollar invested, it was $4.68 returned. I believe the state was just 2 cents under that, if I remember correctly, it was $4.66, but certainly right in that range.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, do you want to call on the rest of your witnesses then?
I think that will complete the testimony from witnesses this morning.
All right. Then we have someone who wanted to testify in opposition to the bill, Molly Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Molly Olson. I live in Little Canada, Minnesota. I'm the founder and volunteer executive director of the Center for Parental Responsibility, emphasis volunteer. I'm not paid to be here as a volunteer. I'm speaking on behalf of 1,000 CPR members who look to CPR to be the family law watchdog for bills like this that hurt families but slide under the radar under the guise of helping children when in reality they are unnecessarily taking from the public fisc to merely build a bigger unnecessary government bureaucracy and save jobs. It's appalling to me and offensive to me that this is done under the guise of helping children when the services are not going to the needy, but rather being used to subsidize free legal services to the rich, upper middle class, and create more conflict between parents, working to punish and marginalize one parent at the expense of the other. The truth is, the bill, HF 64, is a financial fraud on the citizens of Minnesota. Fiscal responsibility is a growing trend no matter what your political persuasion. Controversy arises when government programs are cut from services that are supported by a huge lobby. The bigger the lobby, the louder the outcry. The biggest lobby for government child support system is government workers themselves, who inflame the emotions of the citizenry and the legislators to grow the bureaucracy. The bill is about child support and enforcement and collections. I'm the first to say there's a necessary and legitimate need for child support. I'm not against child support. There's no dispute that both parents should be responsible for supporting their children, both with the care and nurture as well as the financial support according to their ability to pay. For the record, I don't pay child support. I don't receive child support. I'm not married to anyone that is in either place, nor do I have a partner affected by in either way. I'm completely personally unaffected, except that you are spending people's money, and that money is mine too. The question I have is who should be collecting the child support in private family matters, who are getting free attorneys to enforce that? Any legislator claiming to be fiscally responsible should steer clear away from this bill. Unless you believe in welfare for the rich and free government legal services for anyone and anyone who's unmarried with kids. The concern about the budget shortfall in this Title 40 Child Support Enforcement and Collection Program is utterly misplaced priority for fiscally responsible legislators. What is Title 40? Very few people even know what 40 is, much less understand it. I gave a one-hour presentation to legislators in November of 2005, and I'd be happy to explain that detail to anyone, anytime, upon your request. When you think of welfare, and Title 40 is a welfare service program. You've heard other people testify it's to help people, low-income people. Well, that's what we think of when we think of welfare programs. You're right. Even the rubric in the federal law for Title IV said services to needy families and children, emphasis on needy. Have you ever heard of a welfare program that has no eligibility standards, no means testing? How fiscally responsible is that? It defies common sense. All other Title IV programs, except for this one, require some part kind of means testing. The Title IV-D program, this program, should be no different, but it's completely overlooked by legislators. The Title 40 program for which this bill is seeking funding requires no means testing, no eligibility standards, so a parent earning $150,000 a year living in a $1 million home would qualify for these county attorney services you are being asked to fund today. Let me explain how it's really supposed to work. The program, Title 4D, was started in 1974 for two purposes and two purposes only, which you've heard reiterated here. And the scope has never been expanded. The congressional record is abundantly clear. The 4D program is meant for those on welfare and at risk of falling on welfare. The federal program is designed to offset what is being paid out for child support, going after absent parents for cost recovery and cost avoidance to save taxpayer money. It's never been intended to be a program for all divorce and all paternity actions, which has happened here in the state of Minnesota. Why has this happened? Well, a former head of the California Child Support Office made it clear to the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee when she said, this program rewards good outcomes at the local levels by encouraging states to recruit the middle-class families, never dependent on public assistance, never likely to be so, into their programs in order to maximize federal funding. She goes on to say, my colleagues across the country tell me the way to win at this is to bring more orders in, more middle-class orders, recruit those people to bring higher orders in so we get more money from the federal government. She was appalled. The General Accounting Office has said that it's inappropriate to put anybody in this program that doesn't meet those standards on risk of welfare and on public assistance. Donna Shalala has said that a guarantee of these services for everybody would bankrupt agencies across the country. You know what? She was a prophet. Seems like that's happening now. So they say in this testimony that there are no options. There are options. We can put eligibility standards and means testing in place of this program. Currently, in Minnesota, there is 4D funding that is provided for or from 300,000 Minnesota parents who are not lawfully qualified to be in this 4D program in the first place. 65% of the people in this program in Minnesota do not fit the qualification Congress intended on welfare and those at risk of being on welfare. On behalf of your constituents, our organization is full of your constituents, I ask you to do due diligence so your constituents and the citizens of Minnesota can trust you with their pocketbooks. And that you would understand better why this $8 million does not need to be spent. Not only should the legislators not fund this shortfall, they should reduce funding further in the 4D program and limit access to the program to those it's intended, those at risk and those on public assistance. We object as citizens to any further funding of this program, and we believe that further oversight definitely is needed to maintain this program within the scope that Congress intended. There's no need to take self-sufficient people, encourage dependency on this government welfare program, and give them virtually free county attorney services, and thereby they get free court costs on top of it. It defies common sense. It defies the purpose of welfare. It defies the purpose of this program. We plead with you to be fiscally responsible and vote no against SF 864. Thank you. Any questions?
Are there any questions?
So, Madam Chair, I want to apologize for being late, and I'm just assuming that you're, I don't know what her name is. What's your name?
Ms. Olson.
Molly Olson.
Okay, Ms. Olson. So I'm assuming you're opposed to this bill then?
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Olson, I don't have a bill in my division that changes the income eligibility for the child support program. Are you aware of any bill like that in the
last two sessions? There has been a bill, Madam Chair. There has been a bill the last two sessions like that, and we've been working our way through the legislative process, and we are within days of getting another bill this year.
Okay, but I don't have a bill like
right.
that in this committee. And I would say that, you know, a two-parent family making $20,000 a year is not going to be able to hire an attorney.
Oh, I totally agree.
Child support. So what the counties are here saying today is, you know, they're not going to be in a position to serve that $20,000 two-parent family if they don't get some financial assistance with the cuts that have been made at the federal level.
Madam Chair, I contend that if they take the people, the 65% of people that shouldn't be in the program, if they take those off the program, they'll have far more resources, people, and money to spend on those people that really need the services.
Well, that's not what they're saying today.
Right,
to us,
we disagree.
So, yeah. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I think if it would be possible, the county attorney would like to respond to this.
Sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to comment on two particular aspects of the law governing this area. One is that we do not have the option to put into place income eligibility requirements, the reason being that this is a federal program governed by federal law that we, in fact, administer. And so we cannot put income eligibility requirements into place. The second thing I want to make sure that is understood is we do not, as county attorneys, handle divorces for people going through the family court program. Our role is limited to making sure that child support is collected for the children of our community.
And Ms. Gertner, if you're not able to institute some kind of means testing in the program, then how would a county be able to just unilaterally say we're not going to serve parents unless they're on public assistance?
We could not, Madam Chair, make that decision. And if a renegade county were to violate the law and do that, not only would we be violating the law that we are to uphold, but also we would lose 66% and many other funding streams from the federal government. We cannot put in income eligibility requirements.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions?
May I respond to that?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Gardner. I know that I believe we've put in place a 1% charge for people who are not eligible for, do not meet, are above poverty guidelines to help pay for the cost of these collections. Would we have any further latitude in terms of high-income families or high-income people being able to be to share the cost of child collection any further, or is that as far as we're allowed to go under the federal government's rules?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware, Senator Fischbach or Olson, Senator Olson?
Olson.
Sorry. Okay, you're in between the two.
There we go.
Senator Olson, I'm not aware that we could do anything that would make the fee that's paid contingent on income. Again, we cannot base our decisions on income eligibility. I will tell you from administering the second largest program in the state that this is not something that we see as a concern. I would reiterate my testimony that 77% of our clients in Ramsey County are either on public assistance or recently on public assistance. They are families on the edge.
I think I'd like to follow up with the gentleman from the department, if I could. So if we're not able to differentiate based on income in terms of cost sharing in the program, how is it that we are charging this 1% now?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think I might disagree a little bit with the county attorney on that matter. I think we could implement any different number of types of fees, and one that might be graduated according to income. I would caution the committee, though, that were we to build in an eligibility system in the child support program, that would be hugely expensive. And I don't have figures to tell you what that would be like, but it would be...
Well, I don't think we were thinking of that. I think Senator Olson's question simply was, could there be more cost sharing in the program based on income?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think we heard. There could be. It depends on how you do it. I think the federal law allows for fees. And we chose to implement a 1% fee for people not on public assistance and who've been off public assistance for at least 2 years. That was just one way to raise money. There are others.
Okay. Other questions?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that I don't think that the state and myself are in disagreement, actually. I want to emphasize that as a county, I cannot change the fee that's being levied on the various caseloads. So that is a state action. And I also want to emphasize that, in fact, there is income-based cost sharing under this fee program. When you have 1% being collected of a $250 a month order and 1% of a $2,500 order, then you are cost sharing based on income. It is a percentage of the amount collected, and therefore that is based on income.
Well, it is, but I guess I think the question was directed at, you know, what you're doing is you're reducing the amount of child support then that family also has to support their children with. And I think the thought that Senator Olson was trying to get on the table here, is it possible for, you know, families where they would they would not miss the money as much to be able to contribute more. I think that was her thought.
And Madam Chair, just to follow up that thought, I think there are some real advantages to having the county involved in collecting child support in terms of the ability to enforce orders and just the weight of having the county behind these actions that are much more difficult and expensive to accomplish at the in the private sector. And so probably I would guess that even people at the high end might be willing to pay to have the benefit of that service as opposed to the possibility of losing it.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I also want to emphasize that in those cases where higher amounts are involved, generally the higher income parties do hire their own lawyers. So, I mean, I can't emphasize enough that the hours a day we spend on child support enforcement are spent on the people who really need the money. That's the reality of the day-to-day work we do.
So, Ms. Gartner, you don't believe that if we would try to go to a higher cost-sharing model for higher-income families that we would actually generate very much revenue?
Senator Berglund, that is absolutely correct.
Senator Olson?
And, Madam Chair, just as we discuss this, I guess the other side of the coin is it occurs to me that there's a possibility if we made it too expensive for those high-income families, they might go out of the program, since they are paying on a percentage of a larger number, and then perhaps not make that money available to help collect from lower-income families, possibly. I don't know.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to comment on that just a little bit. Even for the very high-end people that we're providing services for, we can't just charge more and more money. There's a ceiling on the amount of money that we can charge, and we can't charge more money than it costs to run the program, for example. And so even on a 1% fee, there are some people at the very top who are capped at the amount, and we don't charge a fee after that. There's not a lot, but there's a few. And so I think if you think that you could put in a program to charge a lot of money to certain people up here, I don't think the law won't work that way.
Senator Berglund,
Senator Sharon.
As you know from our earlier discussions when we were reviewing this issue, I was concerned about the fact that this percentage that's being discussed right now is on the is taken from the money that's collected and taken away from the family, rather than, and I think we ought to spend some time, not necessarily today but in the future, reviewing what work was already done, to look again to see if this can be shifted over. A part of the original court order when child support is established to indicate that a percentage can be collected from the person who's in arrears if they fail to meet their obligations in a timely manner, resulting in all of this public effort in order to get a person held responsible.
Well, Senator Sharon, I certainly would encourage you and any others that have an interest to work on that. It's something that I think would be fruitful, especially in light of the pending federal cuts. Any other discussion? Thank you, then. Senator, you want to lay the bill over for possible inclusion then?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like to introduce an amendment to the bill, and I'd like to have some discussion on the amendment. This is something that emerged late, and I haven't had a chance to talk with you about this, so I would be interested in your consideration of this and your reaction to it. But the amendment, if it is here, can be passed out. This would this amendment simply adds language to the original bill and puts it in the form that I would intend, and that is that this and the reason I'm adding this amendment, by the way, is because this is until the federal government reverses its decision about this or changes its position, this will be a chronic problem. So I'm offering an amendment that would indicate that this appropriation becomes a part of the base appropriation.
Senator Sharon, I think it's okay for us to go ahead and adopt this amendment. I'm not very hopeful that we'll be able to fund it this way, but if we are not able to, we'll just take it out. The language follows the tracking, so.
That's fine. It would be great if it could become a part of the base appropriation if it continues to be an issue at the federal level.
It would be great if we can find some money for this at all.
That's right. And
so Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
And I'd move Senate File 864 be laid over to be considered in with this amendment in the omnibus bill.
So Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 864 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. We're going to take Senator Rosen's bill next if she's here.
She just walked out. There she comes.
She's here now. Sorry, bad timing, but. While she's coming up to the table, members, I will just, in case you haven't checked your email recently, announce that we probably will be having a meeting next Friday, and I know we haven't been having Friday meetings so far, but just a little advance notice so that you can make your schedules work appropriately.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and fellow members. And thank you very much, Madam Chair, for accommodating me. I really appreciate this. I have before you Senate File 532, which basically is a bill that provides changes to county chemical use assessment requirements. And just a little background on this bill. Senator Jane Ranum had it last year and was not able to get it all through because of the situation last year. But it stems off of the legislative auditor's report that was released in February of 2006 that examined the availability and outcomes of substance abuse treatment in community-based and prison-based settings. I have with me today Joe Alter from that office. So if you have any questions, we can go through there. But basically, I'll just run through the bill very quickly. Section 1 specifies who's responsible for doing a chemical use assessment, the circumstances and the timeline. And Subdivision 1, when a person's arrested or taken into custody outside of a person's county of residence, the chemical assessment by that person's county must be completed within 3 weeks after the first request. And if it's not completed, the county where the person is to be sentenced must complete the assessment. In Subdivision 2, if the assessment is required on somebody on someone who is on probation or under correctional supervision, the person's probation officer must be notified. In Subdivision 3, Madam Chair, I do have an amendment that I'd like to add on to that subdivision, and I have a handout here also, please. I would like to move the A2 amendment, please.
I think it's in your packets, members.
In this subdivision, basically, it prohibits the assessor from any direct or shared financial interest with the treatment provider unless, number one, the assessor is a specific provider for specific age, sex, or sexual preference. Number two, the county does not employ enough qualified assessors. And, Madam Chair, this amendment would add a number three, where the assessor has a reputable reputation based on existing contractual relationships between the assessor and the county. And the handout that is being passed around right now basically clarifies there are some situations throughout the state where these relationships between the county and the community health center that have been doing the assessments and the treatments. And so the agreement will still be the responsibility of the county, and we're just making sure that this is copacetic, basically. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Any discussion of the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, that using Washington County is just an example. It isn't just limited to Washington County.
No. Okay. Madam Chair, and Senator Prentner Solon, that's right. We're just using that. That came up to my attention yesterday, basically, from Senator Saltzman and a situation in her county. But there are other situations like that throughout the state.
Okay, any other discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Section 2 is, this is where the fiscal note comes in. The duties of the Commissioner of Human Services would, for example, distribute information to chemical health assessors on best practices. Number 2, propose a directory for chemical dependency treatment programs, which I think is very important. And number 3, track the best practices for monitoring clients' treatment programs. And Section 3 and 4 are reports, to summarize that. Section 3, the report will analyze the maintenance of effort of the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund and look for posting online reviews of placements. And Section 4, the Commissioner of Human Services will report on the progress to the legislative body. I think these are all very important because we do need to get our hands around the assessment chemical dependency treatment assessment programs, what we have out there, so we can make sure that the treatment program is geared towards the proper assessment of that person. So,
okay. Mr. Alter, did you want to make any comments?
Madam Chair, I would only say that the provisions of the bill, as Senator Rosen said, are related to the recommendations in our report, and we appreciate her bringing this bill back. The A2 amendment was not something that we specifically addressed in our report, and that would be a policy change that obviously is your prerogative, but the bill before you, again, reflects our recommendations.
Senator Prentner Solon.
Madam Chair, I have one clarifying question, Senator Rosen or Mr. Alter. If a person is arrested and taken into custody in a county outside that person's residence and the county of residence does not perform that assessment within, 3 weeks? And so the county where they're incarcerated performs it, is the county of residence billed, or does the county that where the incarceration is
Madam
to
Chair,
pay for that?
I believe
Senator
I
look, Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Prentner Solon. I believe, looking into it, the financial responsibility belongs to the county of commitment.
Really? Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Senator Prentner Solon.
So,
I think this is a bigger issue than this bill. I think it deals with how the statutes have been designed around the issue of county responsibility when people are residents of other counties in general.
I understand that, Madam Chair, but there is no incentive for the county of residence to pay for it then. I mean, or to come forward and do the assessment.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner Solon, that's what's in the statutes right now.
Okay.
Is there someone from the department?
Madam Chair, Deb Moses from Chemical Health. The county of residence is responsible for the treatment, and it's in the residency rule, no matter who does the assessment.
So it is the county of residence.
Okay. Yeah, and jail time is uncounted time towards residency.
Okay. I have a few questions about the fiscal note, if there's someone from the department who wants to answer questions about the fiscal note. Most of this fiscal note basically has to do with staff, and so, and you're asking for 3 positions. And as I read the fiscal note, you're asking for 2 additional positions regarding county monitoring. And this seems to have to do with the capturing of county information on a web-based system. And so I'm just, it seemed to me that the county is putting this information forward to then be posted. So maybe you could just explain to me what the two positions would be doing.
Madam Chair, I'm Don Allen, Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration at DHS. The positions would be, number one, providing analysis of the data that comes in to identify where there are trends that are not in line with what we're seeing on the treatment side of our information collected, and then also people to go out and work with counties and provide technical assistance and get their assessment procedures back on track. So basically staff to act on the anomalies that we find in the data.
And how many counties are you anticipating would need assistance?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's one of the things that's germane out of the OLA report is that we don't have any data about county assessment practices. We had a spike in treatment admissions in the beginning of state fiscal year 06, which caused the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund forecast to go up markedly. This spike in those admissions could have been read better, I think, if we had better information about the assessment side of the process. If we saw that there wasn't really a concurrent trend in people presenting themselves for treatment, then I think maybe we would not have reacted in the forecast to the spike that we saw in the beginning, first quarter of 2006, would have made our forecast more accurate. So I think there are some benefits in being able to do that kind of analysis.
And what is the one position that you are allocating to this activity, regardless of whether this bill passes? What is that person going to be doing?
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I'm having trouble finding that in the fiscal note.
Well, if you look under assumptions where it says county monitoring, at the end of that line it says the department is currently allocating one analyst position to this activity.
Yes, I see. Thank you. Madam Chair, DHS recently, within its internal reallocation, had responded to a request to have more data analysis capacity within the Chemical Health Division. That's a general position in which we're more analysis out of the DANE system. The DANE system has recently been upgraded to collect more data and more data in a longitudinal way about treatment and people that are referred to treatment. And that's what that position is doing.
So that person wouldn't have any responsibility for any of these other things.
Madam Chair, if the data became available, I think that person could spend some of their time on that.
And then the other position that you're asking for is in regard to additional assessment-related duties, including dissemination of best practices and standard model assessment instruments. So that person would be doing that separate from trying to provide better compliance information to counties that needed it?
I believe that's correct, Madam Chair.
would seem to me like those two activities are very closely related.
Madam Chair, I think that that's probably correct. I think it's a matter of how fast you want the waterfront covered.
Okay.
Covering 87 counties with one staff person is a daunting task.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
The Section 2 of the bill that does describe the duties of the Commissioner of Human Services is pretty extensive. That's always the question, though.
Right. Of course, you know, when the report came out, most of us thought that the things that they were asking the department to do were things that they already had responsibility to be doing. So some of us were a little surprised when the bill came forward and it had all this cost in it, some of which got covered last year. Well, are there any other questions? If not, Senator Rosen, do you want to make your motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to Senate File 532 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill.
Any further discussion of that motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Olson, do you want to go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here on behalf of Senate File 638, which is the bill for additional funding requested by the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. I'd first like to draw the members' attention to a very detailed brochure that I think you all have a copy of. It's this pink brochure, which provides not only reasons supporting the request for additional funding, but I think will be a very, very valuable resource for the members to bring back with them for future purposes. I have to admit, Madam Chair, that before becoming involved in the legislature, I really wasn't as familiar with the Community Action Partnership and really the valuable services that it provides for the poor in our state. Basically, the Community Action Partnership consists of 28 private nonprofits plus all the Indian reservation governments in our state and is charged with the responsibility of providing community services within an umbrella of a number of different programs specifically directed to improving the situation of poor people around the state. It consists of our food assistance programs, WIC programs, Head Start, Meals on Wheels, and many, many other programs which are designed specifically to address homelessness needs, hunger, and housing needs, among other needs of the poor. On a statewide basis, there are more than 100 different programs within the umbrella of the Community Action Network. Specifically in my area, the Bi-County Community Action Program, or known as BICAP, is the agency that administers these programs. But the pink tab in your brochure will indicate which program relates to your specific district. These are programs that have seen significant cuts at a time that we are all aware there's been a widening gap between those who have who are prospering in our state and those who are falling farther behind. The unique thing about this program and the services that it administers is that and on a local basis, they can decide which programs are most suited to the needs of a specific area, and the funds are directed specifically to meet those needs. These are the programs that the cuts in recent years have most directly affected a number of different, the elderly and the poor in our communities, and at least from my, I have heard from many of my constituents how these cuts have affected their lives directly. When we're looking for ways to spend our money in a way that will make a significant difference in the long run to improve the lives of the poor and move them into a position where they will become less of a burden on the taxpayer in the long run, these are dollars that would be very wisely invested for that purpose. And so we are asking, Madam Chair, that you consider a significant increase in the amount requested by the governor, and that you increase the $8 million in the governor's budget to a total of $20 million, which would be a $12 million addition to the governor's recommendation. Because of the weather today, I have a little change in terms of witnesses. With me here today are John Woodick, the executive director of Minnesota Valley Action Council from Mankato, Wanda Muhammad, the director of programs for Community Action of Minneapolis, and Arnie Anderson, executive director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership, who would have detailed information for any questions you may have about the program. So I'd first like to introduce you to Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. And in the interest of time, my remarks will be extremely brief this morning. I would like to point out that handed out a letter from Lucille Moe. I think when she discovers that Fribourg County was strong enough to get here this morning and Bemidji was unable to make it, that it will bring a smile to her face. The one thing that I would like to stress is that it's very difficult for us to tell our story, and so that we appreciate your attempts to try to understand what we do. Our programs are both very deep and very wide. One of the examples of what Community Action does is in housing development in Three Rivers Community Action, the tax rolls actually are increased in excess of the money that of the public money that goes into the low-income housing development. In the Little Falls area, the Community Action Agency is engaged in a national partnership with Johnson & Johnson to educate parents so that low-income parents are able to more effectively access the healthcare system, and so that the healthcare services are more cost-effective. In your book, there's a list of over 100 programs. If time permitted, we could sit with you and tell story after story, both heartwarming and heart-wrenching, of how Community Action works in your local area. I would like to introduce John Woodwick, the executive director of the Minnesota Valley Community Action Action Agency Council, to give you an example of one specific way that Community Action uses this funding to create an innovative program.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As Arnie said, my name is John Woodwick, Executive Director of the Minnesota Valley Action Council. We are four communities, not-for-profit. We serve the nine counties of South Central Minnesota, and we have since 1965. Senator Olson talked about the uniqueness of Community Action and that we are able to have some funding, and that's what the bill before you is about, that allows local organizations that are have local boards that are one-third elected officials, one-third people that are to be served, and one-third from the community sector that sit on the boards and help determine the direction and the unique needs that are prevalent in every area of Minnesota. One of the things, being from South Central Minnesota, primarily rural, is that transportation is a strategic issue. One of the things that we have been able to do is create a program through partnership with our community. We sort of recognized long ago that we can't accomplish anything unless we get our community involved in the process. But we were able to design a car transportation program that actually sells or leases vehicles to low-wage workers or people that are trying to make the transition from MFIP to employment. We have relied on getting donations from vehicles, for vehicles from the community, and they've come from individuals as well as some car manufacturers or car dealers. We originally started this program in 1998 with McKnight money. Then as McKnight funds diminished, we have utilized our community action grant in order to support this activity and change it over time because the financial landscape has been changing for a long time. But one of the things that we were able to do is get people into vehicles that get them to work. How do you keep your job? You show up. And that's what this program is about, helping people show up for work, keep their jobs, pay taxes, support their families, support the community. In 2004, just very proud about this, but we submitted an application to the Peter F. Drucker Innovation Nonprofit Innovation. There were 229 nonprofit organizations from around the country that submitted their initiatives. And Minnesota Valley Action Council and our We'll Get There program was identified as the winner, the recipient of that innovation award. Along with the recognition of that, there was also a $20,000 award by the Drucker Award, and we've utilized that in order to infuse into the We'll Get There program in order to purchase cars. As I said, we've relied on donations for our vehicles. It's for the last 3 years, it's hovered around 100. There are not a lot of repeat customers that can donate vehicles because who has that many sitting around in their garage willing to give away? So we are constantly looking for new avenues in order to bring vehicles into this program. It is designed, again, utilizing our community action grant funds to try and perpetuate itself and not rely solely on government money. And we do that through a lease option where it brings money into the program in order to continue it. So that's just one example.
Madam Chair, while our next witness is coming to the table, if the members look at the yellow tab, the pink tab, you'll see a number of the different programs that are actually, I guess it's the blue tab. We'll show you the programs that are impacted within the umbrella of community action programs, and I'm sure you'll recognize many programs that are vital services in your area. And I think also Mr. Woodwick's testimony emphasized is that this is an example of what we've said as a government that we want to happen in our communities, true partnerships between the private sector and government, and that has been happening. In 2006, for example, $4 million in community action grant funding leveraged $250 million in other funding, including $15 million in local and private funding. In 2006, 39,000 statewide volunteers donated nearly 2 million hours of service with a value of at least $10 million. So I think it's important as a state that we step up to the plate and make sure that we continue to allow this type of leveraging to occur and this type of programming to go forward. The next witness I have is Ms. Muhammad.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Wanda Muhammad. I am the Director of Programs and Services for Community Action of Minneapolis. Once a homeless man in a substance abuse program, now 3 months shy of earning a degree in culinary arts,
wants a Hurricane Katrina evacuee with nothing, now a pharmacy technician. Wants a single mom with three children and a high school education, now a holder of a BA degree, working full-time, but she still can't afford her health care to include her children. A loss, $695,000. Six programs and four staff were eliminated as a result of the funding loss several years ago for our agency. The cuts represent approximately 1,500 to 2,000 people who aren't served by our agency each year. It's much needed funding to cover mental health services. It is much needed funding to cover legal assistance. And these are just a couple of the issues as we're trying to help families become self-sufficient that we can't really delve into like we used to at the depth with families. I would encourage you to consider restoring us back to our level because many services are not being provided in the community at the level that our low-income families need. In a lot of organizations, it's true that when all is said and done, there is more said than done. But in community action agencies, I can assure you, when all is said and done, there is more done than is really being said. And I think the Pink Book really tells the story about all of the people that we reach and the innovative programs, and the flexibility is so important for us to have those funds. Like at our agency, when we heard that the Katrina evacuees were coming, we were able to use some of those funds and redirect to be able to provide those services immediately for those families in need. Also, with this funding, we are required every 2 years to do a needs assessment within our local communities, and then we structure our programs and services to meet those needs. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair, as a former board member for Community Action Duluth and also the past chief author of this bill, at a time when I wasn't able to move this bill anywhere because of the circumstances here in the state, and I know we're not much beyond that, but a little bit brighter circumstances, I feel very passionately about restoring these dollars to community action, knowing the leveraging power not only in human investment but in economic return to our state also.
Thank you, Senator Prettner-Solon. Are there other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I wonder, it would be helpful for me if I had a little bit more understanding of, we talked about restoration of funds. Can someone give a little bit more historical perspective of the magnitude of the issue before us?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, could Mr. Anderson address that question?
Certainly. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, in 2000, the Community Action Grant was funded at an $18 million level. And then in 2003, it was cut to the $8 million level. So the bill is asking to restore the funding to the 2000 level, including 7 years of inflation.
And, Madam Chair, actually, I think if we had truly added 7 years of inflation to the 2003 levels, we'd be requesting a much higher number than we are.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I represent Olmsted County, and want to echo Senator Prettner-Solon's remarks regarding the impact that these dollars have on our communities. And I think that certainly one of the frustrations that I think many of us share sitting at this table is trying to find the balance between the financial realities that we face in programs like this that we know are really very powerful and economic tools for our communities.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question would be for John Woodrick from Mankato. Do you know what's going on in the weather outside? And if you do, why aren't you on your way back home?
Senator Sharon, there are priorities, and this is being here. So.
And I would like to add that I spent some time with the invitation of Mr. Woodwick with Minnesota Valley Action Council. One of the programs that, among others that I looked at, was this transportation program. It's very impressive what they're doing to make vehicles available to people so they can get sustained and sustain work. Yeah. And the creativity they're using to be able to continue that program and to reduce the reliance on state dollars. So I'm just adding my voice to support for what I think is an extremely reasonable request, which is to restore their funding.
Any other questions? If not, I'd just like to say that I think one of the really great things about the community action programs is that they can kind of be the glue that fills the gaps that are left where our other funding programs in the state leave off. And unfortunately, the cut that they took happened at a time when we were creating a lot of gaps. And so I'm sure that their resources are very strained. So Senator Olson?
Yes, just in conclusion, Madam Chair, I would just like to respectfully suggest that there's no better use of state funds to decrease the widening gap between the poor and those who are thriving in our state. And so I would move that Senate File 638 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Any further discussion of the motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thanks.
Members, we will now take up Senate File 461, Food Support Benefit Requirements Modification. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is a bill that is trying to address the concern that we have seen over the past several years rising use of our food shelves in Minnesota and more strain on our food shelves in Minnesota. And at the same time, we see more and more of our food stamp dollars not being utilized in our state. And so this bill does a couple of things to try to make it easier for people to use their food stamps and to apply and qualify for food stamps. Food stamps are a federal program. It is a state-administered program, but it is a federally funded program. So each food stamp dollar that we lose is a federal dollar that could be helping to meet the nutritional needs of the people of the state of Minnesota. The first part of this bill prohibits expungement of food support benefits unless the benefits have not been accessed for 12 months. Oftentimes, people have a small food stamp benefit and they like to save it up. And especially with the elderly, if they know there's going to be a birthday party for a grandchild at their house or something coming up where there may be a need for extra food in their budget, they then will wait to use their food stamp benefit. And what happens if they don't use their food stamp benefit is that they lose that benefit. And so this would allow them to be able to have more flexibility in using their benefit. The bill also would ask the Commissioner of Human Services to implement a simplified reporting form that would require reporting no more than one time every 6 months. Obviously, a simplified form, about 48 other states have for their elderly and disabled, a three-page form for applying for food stamps. And we think more people would apply for food stamps if the application process were simplified. And if we had the reporting less frequent in the program. Section 3 then also instructs the commissioner to create a simplified application form. And I'd like to call on Jessica Webster from Legal Services Advocacy Program to testify about their support for the bill.
Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal representation to low-income Minnesotans across the state. I'm very happy to be here on this bill this morning just because several members have mentioned that there are so many needs for low-income families and there's not enough money to meet them. And this bill it's a federal resource that we're not utilizing. And so I'm happy that this bill looks at a few ways that we can possibly increase enrollment for food stamps for low-income families. And essentially why I'm here is that Legal Aid did an analysis recently that showed that only 60% of eligible Minnesotans are using this resource. We could enroll almost 200,000 more individuals in federal food stamps. So we think we do need to increase awareness of the program. We know that that's true. We know there's a little bit of a stigma around the program, but we think anything we can do to start to work chipping away at that gap would be helpful.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, then just in looking at the fiscal note, there are some one-time costs. There's a one-time cost of reprogramming the computer system, and there are some one-time staffing costs for redoing the application form. But if you look after those one-time costs are over, then the bill actually has savings because of the reduced amounts of reporting that would be required under the bill.
I'll just make one comment, and I appreciate that this is yet another way that members are looking to simplify processes and administrative processes for the constituents that we're seeking to serve and hopefully to increase that accessibility. All right, Senator Berglund.
If there are no other questions, then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 641 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 461.
461, excuse me.
On that motion?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much. Senate File 559 regarding MFIP compliance. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill is a bill that I've been working on for a number of years. And the goal of the bill is to help us make the new federal compliance requirements, which are that 50% of the people in our program must be working a minimum number of hours. And there are a couple of reasons why it's hard for states to meet these requirements. And the actual scoring of this, which was included in the Federal Deficit Reduction Act, was that only two states would meet the performance requirements, and therefore most of the states in the nation would receive financial penalties in their TANF, in their federal TANF grant. And it's not just the loss of the money in the federal TANF grant that hurts. There would be a requirement then for the state to replace that money. So it's kind of like a twofer. You lose it and you got to replace it, so it's twice the impact. So this bill is trying to address, create several mechanisms to address the problem. One of the reasons that it's hard to meet these federal requirements is many families, by the time they're working the number of hours that the federal government requires, they're off the program. You know, we've succeeded. They're off the program. They're moving on their way to self-sufficiency. But that means then we don't get to count them. The other problem is that a number of individuals come into this program with very significant family problems. That's what's caused them to look for the assistance in the first place. And it's not going to take 6 weeks to solve these problems. If you need chemical dependency treatment, you're going to be in need of assessment and referral, and by the time you get into treatment, you know, this 6 weeks that the federal government gives you as a window for getting everything taken care of is going to be passed, and you're not going to have received the treatment that you need. And that can go on with any number of issues that people in the program might have when they come and seek assistance. Then the other issue is that the federal government only is allowing the first year you're in the program to count toward, if you're in education or training, to count toward the work participation requirement. And, of course, we're implementing this program kind of in, or these new requirements in midstream. So we already have people, a lot of people in the program that have been in the program for more than a year already. And so their opportunity then for education to meet the federal requirement is passed. The other issue is that work search is one of the things that in the old program has been one of the bread and butter pieces of the program. You know, you don't have a job, you are supposed to be looking for a job and trying to get a job. But under the new federal regulations, there's a limited period of time in which work search counts as a work participation activity. And after that time, it's only 1 hour a week of the work search that actually counts. So the bill is designed to try to address a number of those problems that we would have in meeting our federal participation requirement, and at the same time continue to keep the word investment in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The idea of the program is to invest in people and in families and help them move into self-sufficiency and help them to be better off in the long run. Under the way the federal government has structured this program, the two easiest things to do and the two things you will see other states doing with more frequency is, number one, to sanction people off the program. If they're not in the program, they don't count against you. And number two, to do workfare, where people have to work just to get their grant, basic grant. And those are the two easy things to do to meet these onerous kind of requirements. I don't believe that it would be in keeping of the Minnesota, in the tradition or the philosophy of the Minnesota Family Investment Program to move in either of those directions. So this bill is trying to avoid that. I will just go through quickly then the provisions of the bill. I have a few amendments, and then we'll take our testimony. The bill has some provisions that would require more child care to be provided, and the bill addresses the child care requirements. There is a provision that prohibits the commissioner from moving programs or activities funded with MFIP or TANF maintenance of effort to other funding sources without legislative approval. Modifies the MFIP definition of participant to include families that would be in what we're calling in this bill a new family stabilization service. It will still be part of the MFIP program. All the requirements of the MFIP program will apply, but it allows us to move these families that are in need of more services than 6 weeks would allow into state-only dollars and therefore not have to count them against the group of people that the 50% work requirement applies to. So the bill goes on then to strike the limitation on the vehicle, the value of a vehicle. One of the things that is makes it hardest for people, both in the metro and rural areas of the state, to be able to meet the work participation requirements is not being able to have a vehicle. And the value that we have in the law today of a vehicle has been prohibitive for some people to be able to have their vehicle and be in the program. And they really don't have a choice. They need to be in the program. So they've had to get rid of their vehicle. The next part of the bill is one of the strategies for looking at how to be able to count people longer on the program when they're successful, and that's by raising the 115% exit level. It is blank in this bill. We are looking at various options and weighing them based on their cost. Section 7 then requires households to report every 6 months instead of monthly. The reason we're trying to have less reporting in this part of the program is because we are going to very closely have to keep track of hours of work monthly. And so to try and offset some of that administrative burden, having the families reporting on the other parts of the program only every 6 months instead of monthly could be helpful. Section 8 then requires the MFIP job counselor to assess an MFIP participant to determine if the participant should be referred to the Family Stabilization Program. Requires an assessment of participants who have been on the MFIP program for more than 2 years, but less than 3 years, and then again between the fourth and fifth year. We remember that the program does have a five-year time limit. And this is just to make sure that the, you know, maybe the original assessment didn't appropriately identify all the barriers that a person might have, and so to make sure that people that are lingering in the program get reassessed. The bill then adds language encouraging job counselors to allow participants who are participating at least 20 hours of work activities to also participate in training activities in order to meet the federally hourly participation rates. And the section is clarifying the calculation of holiday hours, which adds a complication to this federal law that doesn't really take holidays into account. And employers take holidays into account, but the federal law does not. So at a time when there are holidays, it's going to complicate the ability of a participant perhaps to meet the work participation requirement.
Senator Berglund, I see that there's a question, and maybe it might, because this is so lengthy, I think we'll just take the questions as we go through. Senator Plettner-Solon.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund, just clarification. So if we strike the language requiring the 20 hours of work participation, does the participant have to go to school 20 hours, or does there need to be a combination of 20 hours of work and school, or is it just stricken?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Plettner-Solon, the idea of this bill is to use education and training to help make the hours.
Okay.
And so if a person isn't working enough hours, then look at whether they can benefit from some additional education or training and use those hours to fill out the requirement.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Then we also are striking the language in the law today that requires 20 hours per week of work in order to be in a post-secondary activity. Since we can have more flexibility in using education the first year a person is in the program, we believe perhaps they could meet the entire work participation requirement in that first year simply by being in education. And we've heard over and over again over the last few years what a barrier this 20 hours of work is to having people in education and training programs. Section 12 of the bill clarifies that single parents with no children under 6 years of age need to be involved in work activities for 30 hours per week. Single parent families with children under 6 need to be involved in work activities for 20 hours per week. Section 13 creates the new family stabilization service and would give the counties quite a bit of flexibility in moving people into this part of the program if they need to be in this part of the program, and has quite a bit of language directing them how to operate the program. Section 14 provides a $100 per month work participation bonus for participants who are exiting the diversionary work program or terminating MFIP due to earnings and are employed and working at least 24 hours per week. This, again, would help us to count people that we've been successful in moving off the program. They would be able to receive this bonus with state-only dollars so that their time clock is not ticking. Obviously, they would still be required to be involved with the program to the extent that they would be reporting their working, the hours of work that they are participating in on a weekly basis. Then sections 15 to 19 incorporate the family stabilization services into the MFIP consolidated fund by allowing the fund to pay for those expenditures that are related to this new service. And section 19 allows the innovation funds to be provided to counties and tribes as an incentive to those counties and tribes that exceed the performance with regard to the federal participation rate. Section 20 is a technical conforming change. Section 21 modifies the diversity work program by clarifying the calculation of holiday hours. Section 22 prohibits the state from assessing penalties against the counties from October of 2006 through October of 2007. That is the first year that the penalties would apply, and my feeling is that we are getting this passed so late that the counties don't even have one full year to implement this. And I might just say, in regard to some of the technical problems involved with the bill, that if we had been able to implement this even a year ago, we've had the bill before us, but it has been because the department, the governor's office, and the other body were reluctant to take any action on anything in regard to this, that we haven't been able to get this moving. And so it's my feeling that at least in this first year, the county should not have to bear a penalty. Then we repeal certain provisions in the law that make certain citizens ineligible for the MFIP food or cash assistance program. This is a sunset that is also eliminated in the governor's bill, and it repeals the MFIP consolidated fund subdivision related to performance-based funds and obsolete reporting requirements. Then in the next part of the bill, we're trying to provide the counties with some additional funding to help people that either are working but don't have enough hours and for whom additional education is not necessarily going to be helpful or not what the client would wish, and for people that have not found employment after the first 6 weeks of the program. And that would just appropriate money from the TANF reserve account for the purposes of providing supportive services to low-income individuals, including work-study programs, car loans, car repairs, and the MFIP Innovated Services Project and supported work. So we see supported work as being something that would be valuable for someone that has no job at all and hasn't got no hours of work. We see subsidized employment as being something that the counties could use to fill out the hours of work. Someone has hours, but they don't have enough hours. That does kind of describe all of the different tools that we're trying to put together in this bill. I do have some amendments for the bill, and I'd like to take the amendments next.
Senator Berglund, is that the A6 amendment?
One of them is the A6 amendment.
Is that where you'd like to begin?
Yeah, that's where I'd like to begin.
All right.
So I move adoption of the A6 Amendment, page 1, lines 2 through 25, clarify that the new Family Stabilization Program is a separate state program. That means it would be using state-only funds. Not that it's a separate program at the county implementation level, but at the state funding level. Page 1, lines 26 through 36, reinstates the term loan value related to vehicles and has other clarifying language that was requested by the Department of Human Services. Page 2, line 1, requires a subsequent assessment at 24 to 30 months instead of 24 to 36 months. Page 2, lines 2 through 7, clarifies the MFIP work hours. Page 2, line 8, requires non-citizens new in the program to be in the United States instead of the state less than 12 months. This is to help people who are new citizens become acclimated, stabilize their families, and get them started with English as a second language. If they've already been in the United States for more than a year, then we think they maybe are not in need of those kind of services. Page 2, lines 9 through 18, adds a subdivision to the new program, clarifying that the program is a separately funded state program. Page 2, lines 19 through 25, clarifies the work hours for the work participation bonus. And then I have an oral amendment to add at this time, Madam Chair, and that would be page 2, lines 25 and 27, delete an average of.
Senator Berglund, can you repeat what line that's on?
On page 2, lines 25 and 27, delete an average of.
On the oral amendment?
I'm just incorporating that into the A6 amendment.
All right. Thank you. Are there... Senator Berglund moves the A6 amendment. Are there any questions by members of the committee?
It's on page 2.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A6 amendment has been adopted. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, then I have an A7 amendment. And the A7 amendment deals with a problem that the department pointed out to us a few days ago, which is that in order to be able to pay out this $100 bonus, they need to redo the MAXA system, the computer system. And they think it'll take them a year or a year and a half to get the system done. And based on my experience with these things, I think it might take them longer than that to get it done. And obviously, time is critical in regard to these new federal work participation requirements. And so this amendment would allow this part of the program to be county administered, where the commissioner would provide grants to the counties based on need, and the counties then would be responsible for determining participant eligibility for the bonus payment and reporting the necessary information related to work participation rate requirements back to the state. And directs the commissioner to make efforts to modify their computer system that could accommodate this payment assistance and to report to the legislature when the commissioner will be ready to take over the function for the counties.
Senator Berglund moves the A7 amendment. Are there any questions from the committee? On the A7 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Madam Chair.
The A7 amendment, Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, does the fiscal note include that amendment?
No.
Okay.
The fiscal note shows the bonuses starting sometime in 09 after the department would get the computer system up and running. Okay. I have discussed this amendment with the counties. They may have some additional language that they'd like incorporated to help them with this task, but they've agreed with me that it is probably the only solution there is at the moment, and they agree with me that this is an important component in terms of being able to meet the work participation requirements.
Senator Berglund, do you have some testifiers that you'd like
yes,
to
bring
forward?
Yes, I do.
It's our data registry.
I'd like to start with, well, which one do you want to go first? Deborah Schlick. From Affirmative Options Coalition.
All right. Ms. Schlick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senate committee members. I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm the Executive Director of the Affirmative Options Coalition. Our coalition is a statewide coalition of more than 50 organizations. It includes organizations that do direct service with low-income Minnesotans, faith-based networks, and anti-poverty advocacy organizations. I'm here to urge you to support Senate File 559. Our coalition believes this is an important opportunity to do two things. One, to help Minnesota stave off some significant penalties from the federal government and hold together funding. And secondly, to return the Minnesota Family Investment Program to its roots, which is to be an anti-poverty program, to not just move families through crisis who arrive in poverty and leave the program in poverty. So I just want to make a couple of comments to highlight a couple of things. The first is why this bill focuses on making sure there's some way to continue to provide assistance to parents who get jobs that take them off, otherwise would take them off the program. The measure the federal government is using to measure Minnesota's performance in the other 49 states is a process measure, not an outcome measure. It counts what parents currently on the program are doing and whether they're doing enough hours in about 10 activities the federal government officially recognizes as work. It does not include a count of families who get jobs that take them off welfare, which, of course, is the outcome the public and policymakers and our coalition most want to see out of the program. But your ability to help those families take very low earnings, supplement them with some diminished assistance through a bonus or through a raised exit level means that you move those families beyond poverty and you get credit from the federal government for their work and add them to your work participation rate. And I'll remind you that when this state piloted the MFIT program in 7 pilots and used outside researchers in the mid-90s to look at those outcomes, that their longitudinal results 5 and 6 years after the program said that that anti-poverty piece of the pilot program, the piece that ensured families' combination of assistance and earnings moved them beyond poverty, had its most long-held consequences in the well-being of children, and particularly around math and reading scores of third and fifth graders who'd been very young children on the program. Secondly, the piece of the program to support the most vulnerable families on state funds that don't count in the maintenance of effort. Want you to understand that, one, this is just a bookkeeping change. It is not new spending on the state's part. It's just that the current spending won't count as maintenance of effort. Money you're already spending in the working family credit would count as maintenance of effort. So you're not being asked to spend new funding. The second thing this does is it ensures that these families in which parents have recognized disabilities can get the level of service they actually need within the extent the resources are available. The new federal rules would not allow you to provide more than 6 weeks of mental health services, medical services, rehabilitation services, and have that count beyond the 6 weeks, even if you're dealing with a mother with severe mental illness, cognitive disabilities, or severe physical illness. So what this does is it allows the counties to provide the services the families actually need without worrying about very rigid federal rules. And then finally, what this bill does is make it clear that this is the year to invest the TANF block grant in its main purpose, which is to create a strong Minnesota Family Investment Program. And so the spending in supported work slots, in work study slots for parents who are combining education and work, in continuing the integrated service projects that are going on in 8 regions around the state mean that you're investing these funds in a way that increase significantly the chances of hitting the work participation target. And I want to make one final point about the penalty. The first level of penalty you're likely to face in the second year of this biennium, which, as Senator Berglund pointed out, is not only the possibility of losing $13 million in federal funds, but then needing to introduce new state spending to replace that, the penalty can increase each year until it's maxed at 25% of the block grant. So it becomes an increasing significant financial challenge for the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and just want to make note of the time. And at this time, we'll have Jessica Webster.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid, and I know brevity will be valued, so I'll just say that Legal Aid supports this bill. This is the third year that we've actually supported Senator Berglund in bringing this bill. If we had taken these steps 3 years ago, we wouldn't be in the predicament that we're in now to meet this federal challenge. We think we would be meeting it. The provision of this bill that Legal Aid cares most about is really protecting the most vulnerable families and moving them to separate state funds in this family stabilization services. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I'll just try to be very brief, but I just want to, on the record, thank you for the time you've spent in this committee up to this point helping us to understand the need for this, because I know it's very complicated. We don't want to lose these federal funds, and we do want to encourage people to move to work, which I think is the purpose of this program. So I really appreciate the time you've taken to help us understand this issue.
Thank you, Senator
Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, thank you. If there are no other questions, then, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 559, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, with the understanding that there may be some more technical amendments added to the bill.
Okay. Senator Berglund's motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And moving right along.
Madam Chair, I think this will be really a quick bill, the last one I have here. Senate File 772 is a bill that would fund to the Commissioner of Health a birth defects information system. By way of just a little history, I can't even remember how many years ago it was, but it was before the deficit hit us. We had invested in planning for a birth defects registry in the state of Minnesota. And then we were never able to move forward with implementation of it. But there has been some implementation of it in the metropolitan area. And this bill would provide funding then to make sure we could have the program be statewide. And so with that, I will turn the testimony over to Phil Griffith first.
All right.
Two of my witnesses were not able to be here today because of the weather, so sickness and weather.
All right. Mr. Griffin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Lynch. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist representing the March of Dimes Minnesota chapter. And I know that this has been a long committee meeting, and you've dealt with a number of very, very important subjects this morning, and we think this one is equally important, but we do want to be brief and respect your time. As you probably all know, the March of Dimes was founded in 1938 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his effort to abolish infantile paralysis or polio, and has moved on to what it's doing today, which is raising $210 million nationwide, $2.5 million here in Minnesota. They have funded the research of over 12 Nobel laureates, and we believe that the birth defects information system is crucial to helping the ongoing effort that the March of Dimes wants to support in eliminating birth defects and completely eliminating premature birth. I have with me today the State Director of Program Services for the Minnesota Chapter of the March of Dimes, Mary Ann Kuhn, who will read the testimony of a mother who could not be with us today. Dr. Lohr is sick home in bed with 103-degree temperature, and she will send her testimony via writing when she's feeling well enough to compose it, hopefully over the weekend, and we'll get it to you next week. As Senator Berglund said, we did look at establishing a birth defects information system. The Centers for Disease Control has had seed money available to the states to do this kind of work, and 4 years ago we passed legislation enabling our state health department to begin doing a birth defects information registry system with the federal grant money that was pulled down. That money is only available through the end of this year, and so we need to supplant that money and add money to it to take our program statewide, which is what this bill envisions doing. Madam Chair and members of the committee, this information is being used for two major goals. One of them is to help the CDC, and all of the states doing the research so that they can find out what causes birth defects and we can eliminate them. But almost as important for Minnesota, and in the short run, the more important issue, is that surrounding trying to make sure that parents whose children are born with defects are able to be tied into the social service system and the health care system to help them with treatment and with rehabilitation and with other efforts that can go on to make life as normal for those children who have these defects. We do have experts here from the health department who are the people implementing this program. They will be happy if you have questions to share the detailed information with you. But I'd like to turn to Ms. Kuhn and ask her if she would read the testimony very briefly that Jamie was not able to read because she is at home with her baby.
Ms. Kuhn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is her testimony, if you will allow me to. At 31 years old, my pregnancy started off very uneventful. I was healthy, already taking prenatal vitamins. I had conceived naturally. We were surprised when during an ultrasound we were told we were expecting twins. Until about 22 weeks gestation, the pregnancy continued on as planned. At that time, a decrease in utero activity prompted an ultrasound, which showed that my son had started to fall behind his sister in size, and his heart rate was lower than it should be. Follow-up a week later confirmed that the situation was worsening and that I should prepare myself for his demise. I can tell you that being pregnant can physically and mentally be very hard on a woman, but it is extremely hard to be told while still pregnant to prepare for the death of one of your children, one of which you will continue to carry until the pregnancy concludes. I struggled for an explanation as to why this would and could happen and could only be told that this congenital defects were so severe that even if he had survived, his quality of life would be limited and to just focus on my other child. By about my 26th week of pregnancy, my son had passed, but now I had a new concern. My daughter was starting the same pattern of intrauterine growth retardation. She basically was not growing to the size she should be. I started to see specialists weekly who monitored my pregnancy closely, and when preterm labor started at about my 28th week, I was admitted to the hospital, where I basically stayed until they finally delivered her at 33 weeks gestation. While I was prepared for the delivery of my now demised son, the only pre-warning I got from my daughter was that she would be small. With the growth retardation and the early delivery, we expected that. What I was not expecting while in recovery from my C-section was to be told that upon initial check, she had a cleft palate and a heart defect, but someone would talk to us about it. Upon further examination, that list grew to include a syndrome called Pierre-Robin, in which she had no hard or soft palate whatsoever. Her tongue was too short and her chin recessed. When you looked into her tiny mouth, you saw nasal cavities. She had nothing in the back of her throat, which was also not formed correctly. All of these issues greatly affected her ability to eat, and she was shortly thereafter diagnosed as a failure-to-thrive baby. Alyssa was fed through a tube in her stomach until just before kindergarten started. Alyssa additionally had an ASD with an aneurysm in her heart. She will probably have to have surgery to finally correct that this summer. The base of her esophagus was not properly formed, which caused severe reflux, in which we almost lost her due to aspiration in her lungs. She has a severe deep sacral dimple, which is tethered near the base. Technically, she was diagnosed with spina bifida occulta, which basically means we are very lucky, because had there been about a hair's difference in how everything formed, she would have been paralyzed from the waist down. Lastly, her genital urinary tract is a little misaligned, and we won't know for a few years down the road if she will ever be able to carry a child of her own. Fortunately, Alyssa was spared any mental defects or deficiencies and is a happy and very active, though still very small, third grader at Hassan Elementary in the Elk River School District. After over 25 surgeries, my own inability to work for 3 years, and simply bringing up a baby who came from home from the hospital at 3 pounds, 8 ounces, we have gotten to this point the hard way. Still, to this day, no one has ever been able to explain or understand what caused the issues that we have dealt with. I hope you can understand why I feel a birth defects information system is critically needed in our state. I urge you to support the March of Dimes in their efforts to protect communities and improve the health of babies in Minnesota with a statewide birth defects information system. This system is a critical step in finding answers for families like mine. And with answers will come interventions and prevention, and the promise that fewer families will have to experience the incredible tragedy of losing a child to birth defects. I appreciate the opportunity to submit this written testimony, and we look forward to your support in improving the health and babies in Minnesota. That was written testimony prepared by Laura Pitt, who is a mother of Alyssa, who is now 8 years old. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Just briefly, I was not very clear in my testimony the other day over on the House side, and I just want to reiterate it. This is not an appropriation to go to the March of Dimes. It is an appropriation to go to the Health Department to be a part of this system that is being put together nationally by the Centers for Disease Control. We are here to support them, and we really appreciate the time the committee has given us this morning.
Thank you. Members, we have another person who wishes to testify on this bill, Twyla Bays. Please come forward. Braze. Please come forward. And Ms. Braze, I'll just make note that our time is very, very tight. Ms. Braze.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Twyla Braze, and I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare. And we're coming basically to talk about the fact that this is $1.5 million that will be going into a system that doesn't allow parents to stay out of the system or to keep their children from being tracked for their lifetime in the system. And so what I'd like to say to you is I realize that there's no policy in here, that what we're looking at right now are dollars, and that the policy was put in 2004. But what our organization would really like is not to have the state of Minnesota funding a system which will track and do research on those individuals who are in it without the consent of the parents, or once the child reaches adulthood without the consent of the child or even knowledge of the child. And so what we have always asked about this system is that it would have real parent consent in. And although the law says the words informed consent, if you read the law, you'll notice that it says as described in subsection, I think it's 4. And what that says is that the parents can only opt out, but as it is, it's only a partial opt-out. They can only take out their child's personally identifying information, and that term is not described in statute, so we don't even know what that means. In addition to that, they have a form that they have to sign. The form includes the child's name, the child's birth date, and the information about the parents. And so although the letter, which the parents get telling them that they can opt out, says the following, it says this. It says, first that it congratulates the parents about the birth of their child. And then it says, you have the right to remove all data that identify you or your child from our records. But in fact, that's not true, because as soon as they sign the opt-out and it's kept by the birth defects department, it is not removed from the records. And so our request is that we, before we actually give $1.5 million of taxpayers' money for this system, to put in the rights of parents to keep themselves and their children out of the system and keep their children from being tracked as long as the state wants to track their children, I just think that that's the right thing to do. So I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, both of you. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
If not, then I would move that Senate File 772 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Meeting adjourned.
It does include an opt-out provision. The names are expunged and everything's okay. So.